practiced, lipsticked grin. Joe's also quite personable, and since you're both contemporary experts, I've decided we'll reorganize the department a bit, with you and Joe leading it together. Sort of like... She stops, turns to Joe, a curious glint in her eyes. What do they call it in America, Joe, when you have two leaders on a sporting field? Joe gives a sweet smile that breaks my heart in a whole new way. I want that smile just for me, reserved for laughing over pickup lines and talking about the books she's reading and asking her about the framed photos and learning all about Joe from America, my new partner. All the I hate everything tchotchkes in Nigel's shop aren't enough to convey how that word curdles in my stomach.
Co-captains,
Joe answers, with a brightness that seems natural, like she's thrilled about this. Which stings, that she's happy we can't go out now. I wish I could be light about this turn of fate.
Ah, yes,
Emily says, snapping her perfectly manicured fingers.
That's it. Co-captains.
I swear she planned this. You were rude to my niece, so I'm going to find a thoughtful, delightful, fascinating American woman and throw her into your path. And you'll never see it coming because you know nothing about dating, because you didn't think to ask pertinent questions. Instead, you got all caught up in romance, you silly fool. You silly old fool who knows so very little of this new world. The irony. I've got a brain full of insight about art from the 1900s to today, but I know so little about modern affairs.
We're going to make Highsmith the best auction house in the world,
Emily promises us, beaming.
I've arranged a working lunch today, where you can collaborate with the liaisons in marketing and sales who interface with your department.
Joe grins.
I'm looking forward to meeting everybody on the team.
My God, it sounds like she means it. Like she enjoys all this newfangled workplace jargon, interfacing and liaising and whatnot.
We thrive on teamwork. It's our way of working.
Emily chirps, looking at me so pointedly that her eyes could be lasers.
Isn't it, Heath?
I just want to work. That's what has gotten me through loss, helped me stay sane. It's what made me feel alive again, maybe even happy. Surely this is happiness that I feel at work. Work keeps my days from being lonely. It's projects, catalogs, and collections. It's the chance to lose myself in matters of the mind, not in teamwork, collabs, or interactions. The world spins forward. And as it does, I'm pretty sure the budding romance is over before it could begin. I don't have to ask the internet to know that dating your new co-captain is a bad idea. Perhaps even more foolish than failing to ask a woman you like what she does for a living. There are so many reasons I cannot date someone in the office. What if it doesn't work out? Then I'd have to see her every single day, make awkward conversation over tea in the kitchen. That would be the end of my safe place at work. It was silly to think that my first foray into dating after a 4-year hiatus would end in a happily ever after. Teamwork is brilliant, I say unconvincingly. But it doesn't matter because Emily is ushering Joe from the office with a hand on her shoulder. On the way out, Joe casts a look my way, her eyes big and imploring, her smile sad and wistful as she mouths, I'm sorry. My heart winces again as I mouth back, me too. Once she's out of view, I fall into my chair, groaning in abject frustration. Typical. No wonder there's a huge market for hating shit, because horrid shit happens. I drop my head into my hands, but there's no time to wallow. There's a meeting to prep for, and maybe a job to research. I straighten and turn to my laptop, then click on the job opening I applied for here at Highsmith, the one for which I wrote a smashing letter, the one where I can work remotely. Yes, please. A note on my employee portal says I'm still under consideration. That's good. Remote work was appealing already, but I've a sinking feeling the tension will ratchet up from here. The tension of wanting what I can't have. I dive into meeting prep, blotting out the rest of this place as best I can, until there's a knock on my ajar door. I glance up, and my lips twitch in an unbidden smile. Jo stands in the doorway, tucks a strand of chestnut hair behind her right ear, a faraway look in her pretty blue eyes. Is it regret? Hi, I say hoarsely, unable to think of anything else. I take off my reading glasses and set them on my desk.
How are you?
Jo asks, kind and inviting, but still unreadable. I'm unsure how to proceed, but I choose quickly. I opt for honesty. I've been better. She lets out a breath, perhaps of relief.
Same here.
She swings her gaze behind her, then back to me.
May I come in?
Of course. She steps inside, presses a hand to the door and shuts it. Oh, how I wish I could close the distance and kiss her properly, like I plan to do Friday night. Instead, I stay in my chair, maybe so I don't take her into my arms.
So, yeah, fate's a bitch, she says,
pushing out a laugh as she tucks her hair behind her other ear. Put that on a plaque and sell it, I quip.
Yeah,
she says, clasping her hands, twisting her fingers nervously. Her lips curve into a rueful smile.
It never occurred to me that we might work together.
Me neither.
I mean, you seemed like...
She laughs softly, perhaps abashed.
I had this whole idea in my head that you were a librarian.
I chuckle, leaning back in my chair. Did you now? She rolls her eyes, then lowers her voice.
You were my sexy librarian.
A dangerous rumble works its way up my chest. I like those words far too much. I like that you thought of me that way. I like to think I would make quite a dashing one, I tease. It's so tempting to slip back into flirtation with her. Perhaps it's tempting for her too?
Yes, the glasses really do it for me.
She leans against the wall by the door.
I'd have shown up every day, checking out books from you.
Asking for recommendations, I ask, my tone as light as I felt Sunday night.
Yes, I'd have been all. Do you have the newest Sophie Kinsella or Jane Green?
She asks, all pouty. I'd have personally escorted you to the stacks, I say. Good choices, by the way.
As long as they're not drawn from social media feeds, she says,
a teasing callback to our first encounter. That's my only hard limit, I say.
Good to know about hard limits.
Her eyes spark with gratitude, then naughtiness.
Hopefully, there are some dark corners in this imaginary library of yours.
My chest heats. My pulse spikes as we fall into a tantalizing game of make-believe. My imaginary library has many dark corners, perfect for deep and heady kisses, I say in a low voice. A voice I shouldn't use at work. One I definitely shouldn't use with her. But instead of stopping, I stand, walk around the corner of my desk, take a step closer to Josephine Brennan. We're mere feet away. Do you have librarian fantasies, Jo? She tilts her head, shrugs lightly.
Apparently I do. I suppose it usually goes the other way. Sexy women librarians with glasses, hair in a bun until we let it loose. But I pictured you that way, minus the updo. Then when I saw you with those reading glasses, it kind of fried all my circuits.
Fried circuits is my new favorite saying, I murmur, my body alive, my bones humming.
I had this whole image of you, all studious and learned, talking books with me, showing me your favorites.
I hate that I love her image of me so much. I love it so much it unlocks a confession that surprises me. I really wanted to see you on Friday, Joe. Take you to dinner. Show you around London if you wanted. I glance at the clock. Her eyes stray there too. Our meeting is soon, but she makes no move to leave. Have you been here before? To London? I ask. She hesitates. Her eyes flicker with something like sadness, or maybe anger. Perhaps a mix of both. I'm hanging on the edge of the moment, waiting for her answer.
I have. I was here for a few months for grad school, she says tightly, as if the words pain her.
I want to know what's beneath that tension, but now isn't the time. It's also not my turn. She asks,
Are you from here?
Born and raised.
Have you ever lived anyplace else?
I shake my head. No. London is just home.
New York is that way for me,
she says, and I can hear the wistfulness. You miss it. It's not a question. Her eyes shine.
I do. So much. I miss my friends terribly. I miss the madness of New York. All its New Yorkness.
Her answer tugs on a part of me that's been dormant for a long time. I half wanted to ask if you'd seen the Tate or the National Gallery, or if you wanted to. The other night, that is.
At the bar?
She asks, curious. I shake my head. No. In your room, when you were... An image of her soft and naked flashes before my eyes. In bed. After. She trembles.
After, she says dreamily. I felt pretty good after.
I can't stop a low groan from escaping. Good. I'm glad you felt that way. I felt it too.
Apparently the way you felt made you want to take me to a museum,
she says with a laugh. I grin. Well, the cat is out of the bag. Art turns me on.
Same here.
She takes a beat.
So you wanted to take me there? To the Tate?
At the time, I mostly wanted to know what she was doing in London, but I also wanted to take her there, to show her my favorites. Yes. I suppose I did. To show you the J.M.W. Turners and the Monets. It's madness, though. Too many crowds, too many tourists.
But worth it,
she says quickly, excited by the idea. Yes, so worth it. The strange thing is, this moment feels worth it too, even though it's going nowhere.
I love all the Turners,
she says, bringing her hand to her heart, like she's holding that love for the art.
I can stare at them for hours, trying to figure them out.
Me too. His seascapes are so atmospheric, so moody. That's why I like them so much. His paintings brood. They gaze, and they make me think. She leans a tad closer, like she's going to share a secret.
Sometimes, I think they're like puzzles.
And you want to solve the mystery of what he's saying about light or fire or rain, I say. Her smile is dazzling.
I'm convinced there's something there I haven't quite gotten yet, so I keep looking.
I'm always hunting for the answer. I haven't found it yet either, I say, wishing more than ever I could take her there, unlock the mystery with her. We're both quiet for a moment, eyes locked, mouth still.
Heath.
Yes? My reply sounds desperate even to my own ears.
I don't miss New York right this second, and I didn't miss it on Sunday night,
she whispers. There's nothing better she could have said, nothing that could make me want her anymore. All I can do is gaze at her with longing that will go unfulfilled. I wish I could make you not miss New York again and again. Her breath catches. Then she glances at the clock.
I should go,
she says. And with a speed that surprises me, she grabs the open collar of my button-down shirt and tugs me close, brings her lips near mine. Her breath is soft and enticing.
I wanted to see you again so badly, Heath.
I shudder.
Then she brushes her soft mouth against mine, and sparks flare across my skin. From a secret, poignant kiss in my office. One that lasts mere seconds, then ends when she turns to leave.
Chapter 10. Joe. Talk about awkward. I'm in a conference room planning an upcoming collection with three other people, including a man I saw naked. A man I want to see naked again. Heath's across the table from me, wearing his serious face, and damn, that intensity looks good on him. He's Professor Indiana Jones now, all intelligence and wit in the classroom, as he says, "We'd like this to be the type of auction that draws a wide range of collectors, but especially the newer ones." I couldn't agree more, and I want to say as much. My desire to see him naked is frazzling my brain. I also just want to see him, even more than I did when he called last night. So much more. That sharp wit, that gentle soul, the things he said to me in his office an hour ago. Take me to the Turners, please. Show me the gallery. Talk to me about art. We'll solve the puzzle together. My stomach has hitched a ride on a roller coaster, rising up, flying down. Loop-de-loop. Between the naked thoughts and the swoony thoughts, my brain hasn't left much room for the work stuff. That's not helpful as I try to share my own vision for the upcoming collection. And to do that, I think we should, try to procure some of Benedict Winslow's paintings. The words all come out staccato as I mention a London collector, but Rhea doesn't seem to care that I sound like a bumbling frog. She simply smiles, her big brown eyes kind. "I was nervous on my first day here, too," she says, reaching across the table to pat my hand, her gold bracelets jangling. "Don't worry about the collection. We'll get it all sorted, and it will be excellent." I duck my head, embarrassed. If she only knew why I'm a mess. "Thank you. I think I might still be jet-lagged," I say, trying to erase the moment. Way to make a great first impression on your new team, Joe. Don't think about the dinner you're not going to have with Heath at some adorable, trendy restaurant with clever new menu items to delight in together. Don't picture the bookshops you aren't popping into when the meal is through, or the museums you're not visiting the next day. And definitely don't think about the sex you're not having with him after dinner. After bookshops. After museums. All that toe-tingling sex must stop now. Getting involved with a colleague in a new country, in a new office, in a new job is the definition of a no-no. I'm sure the company has a policy on dating a coworker. And even if Highsmith doesn't, what if things ended poorly between us? I've lost my home in New York. I don't have a job to return to either. It's this job here. This life in London, or nothing. I must treat it seriously, because it's all I have. I do my best to recalibrate, bringing my usual energy to the planning. I reroute my attention to my job, which I do damn well. "I've got some great ideas on how to reach a new sector of collectors," I say. "Exclusive video tours of artist studios. A percentage of proceeds to some of the artist's favorite charities. A centerpiece work that we can market online, in our newsletters, and to our regular customers." We toss these ideas about over sandwiches and sushi and devise a plan to make our auctions innovative and fresh for the new collectors, as well as exclusive and bougie for the traditional ones. Freddie and Rhea both have terrific ideas, and they're unafraid to throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. Some of it does, thankfully. Heath is quieter, but when he talks, his ideas are fully formed and right on the money. When we're done, I close my laptop and smile. "Thank you. All of you are making my first day at work in a new country terrific. Even if one of you made it hard for me to focus at first." Ginger-haired Freddie tugs on his bright red bow tie, then raises a hand, like he's asking a question in class.
"Total sidebar.
One of my favourite galleries is having an opening for Petra Lorraine on Friday night. She's a rising star here, and some pop stars have even licensed her art on T-shirt designs, he says. Might be a great chance to check out some cutting-edge works. Do you think? I tense for a second, since that sounds right up Poppy's alley, but I can breathe again when he names the Zora Gallery. It's not hers. That's a huge relief. I think that's a fantastic idea, I say, glancing around. I'm in. Who wants to go? I'm there, Rhea says, enthused. We all turn to Heath for his answer. His brown eyes are hard, edged with something like frustration, but after a beat, he mutters, "Sure." Excitement pings in me. A gallery outing with the team isn't at all a date, but it is a chance to grab a little hit of Heath outside of the office. "Yay! It'll be smashing," Rhea says, then swivels around to face me again. "Speaking of team stuff, do you play darts, Joe?" I scoff, rolling my eyes. "What do you take me for, someone who doesn't know how to hit a target?" Rhea's eyes shine with excitement. "Want to go with us after work today?" An invite to hang out with my coworkers? Way to make my first day even better. I'm giddy. "I'd love to." Rhea squeezes my shoulder. "You're on my team, and you better not be pulling my leg." Freddy chuckles.
"Spoiler alert, Joe. Rhea's total rubbish at darts."
"Am not," Rhea says, playfully stomping her foot. "I'm a dart goddess." I glance over at Heath. His face is stony. "Do you play?" I ask evenly, like I'm not dying to know every detail about him.
"No, thank you," he says, but that's not an answer.
I'm not going to press for one, though, especially since he practically vaults out of the room. Rhea smiles after him, then shrugs. "He hardly ever goes to group things." Freddy snorts.
"Hardly? I'd say never, Rhea."
My lips part, and I start to ask why, but then I reel the word back in. It's not my place to pry. I simply smile instead and leave the conference room, grateful to have plans for tonight. I am a social beast after all. When the workday ends, I'm tempted to stop by Heath's office again, but that would be a bad idea. Except his office is on the way out. As I sling my purse onto my shoulder and walk down the hallway, I pass his door. He pecks away on his computer, dark glasses on. "Good night, Heath. It was great meeting you." He turns to me, a secret grin lighting his handsome face.
"And you as well, Joe. Have fun playing darts."
"Have fun reading?" He removes the glasses and his brown eyes twinkle.
"Excellent guess. But I might also play some chess."
Alone or with someone, I want to ask. But the more I ask, the more I'll linger, and the harder it'll be to walk away next time. "Good luck," I say. Then I go. I join my coworkers at a nearby pub. They're a motley crew, and I love the mix of people and backgrounds. We order pints and exchange bios at a crowded table near the bar. I learn that Rhea, who's Indian, met her boyfriend, who's French, while geocaching, and they now compete once a month against other couples in the treasure hunt hobby. Freddy grew up in Leeds and met his wife Millie at a knitting class. Together, they run a knitting for beginners class every Sunday. I also learn Millie has seen Wicked 10 times, and I practically vibrate with excitement.
"You win. But I have seen it 8, I confess.
She smacks palms with me.
"I go once a year with my friends. We call ourselves the Galindas and the Elphabas, and we go in full makeup," she says, then pats her cheek, her black skin luminous. "And I do look good in green."
"I bet you look fantastic," I tell her.
"I can also tell you which actress playing Elphaba has the best belt."
I sweep out a hand.
"Dish, now, I must know everything."
"Really?" Millie asks with an arch of her brow.
"Of course. Musicals are my Gatorade. They replenish me like electrolytes."
"You're funny," she says with a laugh. Which makes me wonder, Rhea begins, tapping her chin. Millie gives her a knowing look.
Oh, I can tell where you're going.
Rhea smiles, all sweet innocence.
Of course you do, Mill. I'm wondering if she would be a good one for Harry.
Now I, too, know where this is headed. I love it when friends try to set up the new peeps. It's totally endearing, and I've done it myself. I'm not sure I want to be matched, but I'm pleased they're thinking of me that way. Freddy rolls his eyes.
Rhea, Millie, I swear we need to give Jo some breathing room. She just started today.
All the better to grab her for one of our mates before she finds someone on her own, Rhea teases.
Millie gives me an expectant look.
Are you single, or is there a man waiting for you in New York?
I'm very single, I say, wishing it weren't true.
Wishing I were dating the guy I'm working with.
But I'm not actually interested in dating just now. Honestly, I want to focus on work.
That's true, at least. Completely true. Rhea pouts and Millie pretends to sneer. Then we circle to other topics, and somehow an hour has passed while we chat about everything and nothing. Then it's time for darts. As the game begins, Rhea tugs me to her side.
I'm so glad you're here. It's nice to go out with friends from work.
I couldn't agree more. Rhea drops her voice to a whisper.
Heath never goes, but we always try to get him to come with us.
Why is she telling me this? But maybe it's simply to try to explain his absence.
You mentioned that, I say casually, doing my best not to give away my interest in the man who isn't here. I mean, he has his reasons and all, I suppose. But still, we don't bite. We're all nice.
Reasons? What are his reasons? I'm dying to know, but asking would be prying, and I won't do that. Instead, I pick up a dart and fling it at the board. Bullseye. The game heats up and conversation swings away from Heath, as it should. That night, after I flop exhausted into bed, I grab my phone and text my New York friends a photo of a cute hat shop I passed on the way home. Joe.
This is a spot from the book you gave me. I plan on working my way through every Instagrammable location in London.
TJ is the first to reply.
TJ, we knew it would motivate you. I bet it's your new challenge, visiting all the places in the book.
Joe,
oh my God, you gave it to me as a test?
Easton,
and it's working. You're already checking off items, you list maker, you item checker offer.
Joe,
yes, I am. So there.
TJ,
called it.
Emerson jumps in next.
Emerson, so does this mean you've fallen in love with London?
Joe,
I'm not that easy.
Emerson, how was your first day at work? I miss you terribly, and I'm pretending you're in your cute apartment on West 73rd.
Joe,
I'm pretending I'm there too. Hey, let's go meet for a lemon drop at the lucky spot.
Emerson, be there in 15. Lesai. Anyway, you'll like London eventually. Tell me about work. I jump to a thread directly with her, since it's time for girl talk, not group talk with the guys.
Joe.
Ah, there is so much to tell. For starters, you won't believe who Heath is.
I send all the details on the just my luck one-night stand. She replies with shocked face gifts and then a note.
Emerson. That's like fate slapping you with a salami. Ouch!
I crack up. I love her weirdo analogies.
Joe,
I hate salami.
Emerson, so the metaphor worked. What about the date Friday night?
Joe,
we nixed it, obviously.
Emerson,
right, of course. Dating a coworker is a recipe for trouble.
Joe,
exactly. And it was just a date.
Only my plan to see Heath felt like more than a date. It felt like the start of something, beyond just testing to see if we liked each other. We know we do.
Friday would have been the first of more dates, I'm sure of it. Especially when my phone lights up with an incoming call from the man I'm thinking of.
Hi, I say.
Hello. Did you win at darts?
I swear I could be curling my fingers around the coily cord of some fancy Breakfast at Tiffany's phone the way I feel chatting with him. I'm a mistress of the dartboard. He laughs softly, knowingly.
I'm not surprised.
Why is that? I ask, my pulse beating a little faster just from hearing his voice. This is ridiculous, my reaction to this man.
You seem very good at very many things.
I clutch the phone closer, my skin warming from the compliment. And you? Did you win at chess?
Alas, I was checkmated by Griffin in a game in Battersea Park,
he says on a wistful note.
So it goes.
You played chess in Battersea Park? That's so very British.
And you played darts at a pub. Same to you.
You have me there, I say. He's quiet at first, maybe measuring his words. Then he answers,
I wish I did.
My chest flutters. It's going to be impossible to resist flirting with him, but I try. Do you play darts? I noticed you never answered when I asked.
Observant. And yes, I play. Quite well. But I didn't want to let on because it'd make it harder to avoid the dart outings at the office.
I snap back to Rhea's words. He has his reasons. Sometime, maybe soon, he'll tell me why. Then I shall keep your dart prowess a secret.
I appreciate that.
Like last night, neither of us seems in a rush to get off the phone. I know he didn't call just to inquire about the final score at darts. He confirms that when he asks about my flat and if I like it. It's everything I could ever want. A room with a view, I say. He laughs, and I don't know why I should be surprised he caught the E.M. Forster reference.
Not much better than that, a good view. Except maybe a room of one's own.
I chuckle at him one-upping me with Virginia Woolf. Aren't we a pair?
We are indeed.
So where do you live? I ask.
Covent Garden. I always liked it when I was younger. Had my sights set on living here ever since my parents would take my brother and me into the city. They live just outside the city still, Mum and Dad.
Those details, freely shared, warm my heart. I didn't ask for them. He offered, and that matters to me. It's like him sharing the secret of his dart prowess. Before long, the conversation winds down, and he clears his throat.
Well, I just wanted to check in, I suppose. See how your night was, how you're getting on.
He sounds like he needs an excuse for talking to me. And I get it. I like that he called, but I also know it's risky to chat this intimately. Maybe an excuse will make us both feel better about this late-night call. Thank you for checking in, I say.
See you tomorrow. And good night, Joe, my American co-captain.
There's a hint of sad sarcasm in his voice, of course. I feel it, too. Good night to you, too, my British partner. I end the call, then text goodnight to Emerson and the rest of the group, missing all of them, missing my friends in New York, and missing this chance here in London. After work the next evening, I go for a run along the Thames, blasting Rent as I peel off a few miles while the sun sets. I've made it to One Song Glory when my father calls. I hit ignore and focus on Roger and Mark and the New York crew of artists. The phone transcribes my dad's message, and I catch the words this weekend before I shut the notification. It will wait. He's not going to ruin my running mojo. Later, back in my flat, I reply to his request, saying Sunday is fine for a talk. No one else calls me to just check in, and that's fine. Of course it's fine. Why wouldn't it be? The rest of the work week flies by, filling with meetings and phone calls and prep for the upcoming collection. And Heath. My week is filled with Heath as we work together. As I learn things like the way he signs off his emails, with thanks,
formal but not too cold, and the way he taps his chin when he thinks, staring off to the right as if the answer to a question might be right there if only he could reach it. Working with him is hard, but I'm strong. I'm here for that promotion. I left New York for that promotion, and I will not be distracted by anyone. And so, I work. And in the evenings, I keep myself busy by strolling to spots from the book my friends gave me. Since I am indeed a checker offer, I snap pics of all the places, like the very pink Peggy Portion Cafe and the very crowded Tower Bridge. I send them to the crew and tap out replies to their texts. So far, it seems Easton was right. You keep in touch with the people you want to keep in touch with. I still don't love London, but the pictures and the texting feed my lonely soul, which craves connection. But I don't want this week to be a honeymoon period. I want us to stay close. I hope we can. Sometimes I'm tempted to text Heath, but I haven't yet. Not at all. He doesn't seem like a texter, and I'm not sure if I should keep stoking the flames between us with a call. He doesn't call either. When Friday rolls around, my chest aches with the wish I could see my friends over the weekend. Spend it traipsing around Manhattan, visiting a new food truck with Emerson, playing pinball with TJ, running errands with Easton as he preps for a party. But I've got to put that energy into London instead. And into the gallery opening this evening, where I'll see Heath. Maybe this is why I haven't called. Because I've been waiting for tonight.
Chapter 11. Heath. During my lunch break on Friday, I make my way to Nigel's shop in search of an escape, or at least the possibility of one in the form of a book to curl up with. Ideally one that's 5,000 pages long and will carry me through the weekend. When I go in, Nigel is laughing with a customer while he rings up a candle. "Those are hilarious. Great gift," he says to the curly-haired woman at the register.
"It's for my sister, but I'm going to snap a picture of it too. Send it to all my friends," the customer says. "They'll get a kick out of it."
I arch a brow, reading the tag on the candle. Fuck this shit. When the customer leaves, I tip my forehead in her direction. Does anyone even care if it smells good? Nigel rolls his dark eyes. Not a damn soul. That's not why they buy them. But it smells like rosemary, oranges, honey, and cedar. My nose crinkles at the mismatched quartet of scents. Or perhaps it smells like an indecisive candle maker. I like to think it smells like a money tree, since I'm making green hand over fist. From a nearby rack, he grabs a pair of socks with a unicorn saying, "This meeting is fucking bullshit. By the way, these are perfect for you." The last week has only underlined the unicorn's words of wisdom. Meetings are the worst. "My life's motto," I say. "But wait, this is even better." Nigel stretches out an arm and grabs a pair of blue socks. A woman lolls on a bench, her nose in a book. The caption says, "Fuck off, I'm reading." I grin. Brilliant. "And speaking of reading," he proceeds to tell me about a mystery he tracked down for me, a series that's becoming popular in America. Then he reaches below the counter, pulls out the book, and slaps it down on the wood. "Just for you." Before I can reach for it, Nigel snatches the novel back and clutches it to his chest. "But only if you say something nice about me." I glare at him. "Why do you make this so bloody difficult?" "It's like a game. When I lose interest in Sudoku, I can wind you up for amusement." "Glad to be of service." Then I gird myself, taking a deep, fueling breath. "You're the best?" I venture, my brow knit, hoping that hit the mark. Nigel smacks a palm on the counter. "That was hard for you, wasn't it?" "Like pulling teeth," I wince. "Or like finding out the woman you want is your new co-worker." "Ouch, that's terrible." But office romance is a thing, isn't it? For people who don't give a fuck about their jobs, I reply. That's why I haven't called Joe since Tuesday night. It felt too natural, too easy to talk to her after work. I can't let her become a habit when there's so much at stake. My job, the thing I need most for sanity. Fair point, Nigel says with a nod. Best not to mess around where you work. Exactly. I buy the book and return to the office. As the day winds down, I check the clock more frequently. The time for the gallery event is drawing closer. I pop into the men's room, brush my teeth, adjust my shirt, run my fingers through my hair. It's important to look good for work events, and fresh breath is critical for all occasions. I return to my office, stealing another glance at the time. 15 more minutes and we'll all be leaving. I've half a mind to text Jude and ask if it's normal to be so wound up about an evening out with your co-workers. But I don't need to ask anyone, really. I know this feeling. I felt it before, ages ago. The thrill of anticipation. I tell my feet to stay firmly planted. There's nothing to anticipate. Tonight isn't the start of a new romance. Still, my pulse beats faster. Then I come back to reality without a bit of effort when Emily pops her head around the door, rapping her knuckles on it.
Knock, knock.
Come in, of course, I say. Be cheery, be upbeat. I flash her a grin. Then I do something I never pictured at all. I ask a question that has no bearing on the workplace. Any plans this weekend? Her gray eyes twinkle. Emily seems to crave this kind of interaction, I'm learning.
Yes, my wife and I are going to a crafts fair on Saturday near Leadenhall Market. Should be fun. I'll see if I can restrain her from buying every trendy necklace she sees.
Good luck with that. I think that's the sort of thing one says. Maybe I should find a book on small talk in the workplace. I can post reminders of what to ask co-workers.
And thank you for asking,
Emily says, and I mentally pat myself on the back.
How's everything with Josephine this week?
Would be better if she didn't work with me. So much better, because then I could take her out like I want to. Take her on a tour of literary London. Show her Keats House and the Globe Theatre for starters. Fantastic, I say. It's both a lie and the truth. Yes, Jo is bright and energetic and bursting with ideas. And she's also temptation made flesh.
She's great, isn't she? I just don't know how I'm going to pick between the two of you for the VP post.
Emily gives a breezy shrug.
But I like difficult choices. Keeps me on my toes.
Then she sails away, and I stand there, sucker punched. Great. Fucking great. Joe and I are co-captains, and now we're chasing the same job. The indecisive candlemaker got one thing right. Fuck this shit. There's no moment on the tube ride to the gallery to casually mention the job situation with Joe. Plus, Rhea and Freddie are conversational chefs, and they pepper Joe with questions as the train weaves underground. Have you been to the Tower of London?
Ooh, you must get a curry at the Jewel.
The best shopping is just off Notting Hill. I bite my tongue, even though those sights are nothing like the ones I would choose if I were introducing her to London. Once we reach the gallery, throngs of colleagues and clients surround us, and I have to say hello, even though I'm desperate to grab a second alone with her. The four of us make small talk about the paintings and sculptures with collectors, buyers, and other gallerists and art world colleagues. There's barely a second free between the mingling. But around seven, it's somehow, mercifully, just the two of us standing in front of a painting of the ocean on fire, so I decide to go for it. I've been meaning to ask.
Now, that's haunting,
she says at the same time as she points at the image. Then she laughs.
Sorry, you're saying...
Maybe now's not the time. I nod at the painting. Yes, it's a little terrifying.
Reminds me of a Turner, she says.
And here we go again, slipping into these moments of connectedness. We chat a little more about the art, and surely this is where I can return once more to the work issue. So I hear we're chasing the same prize. So, as I was saying, I begin. A familiar man slides up to my side, waving grandly, all grey eyes and big beard.
Heath! Good to see you again. Have you checked out the Rothkos at the Tate?
He asks. Then his eyes swing to Joe.
Oh, hello there.
I introduce Joe to the collector and vice versa.
Richard, this is Joe. She's a firecracker from New York. Brilliant and bursting with ideas. She's working with me at Highsmith. How wonderful! Bet you make a great team, he says.
Joe pats my shoulder in a collegial sort of way.
Yes, and Heath has fantastic ideas, too. I love working with him.
Is the same true for me? Do I love working with her? Not entirely, but it's not her fault. It's fate's fault, since work has gotten in the way of dating her. We chat with Richard for another minute, and as that wraps up, I vow to try once more to broach the job topic. Then Zora taps Joe's shoulder to get her attention.
I've been dying to meet you,
says the gallery owner to the woman by my side.
And I you,
Joe says, and the tattooed and nose-ringed woman promptly steals her away. And here I am, alone. But alone is fine. I can commune with the art. I wind through the gallery once again, studying the prints and lithographs as well as a few small sculptures, when I hear my name in an unmistakable voice.
Heath Graham, it's been too bloody long.
I wince, then clear my expression before I turn toward the speaker. Victoria Kavanagh is a dealer who reps some artists in a collection I handled last year. She waves with her fingers, all covered in skull rings.
You! I've been meaning to talk to you about someone, she says,
and my blind date radar starts beeping.
Eager to talk about the new Rothko exhibit over at the Tate, I quip,
as if that will deflect the request incoming in 3, 2, 1.
Ha ha, you're adorable, but no.
She steps closer, getting in my space, smashing through personal boundaries as she wraps her hand over my shoulder.
My sister's next-door neighbor is a bookseller. She has this adorable children's bookshop in Cecil Court.
My God, that was fast, even for Victoria.
How wonderful for people looking for books, I say.
She raises a finger and bops me on the nose. I don't even know what that means, but it's going on my list of things to avoid at all costs.
Wonderful for you too, Heath. Lily is cute. She wears these pink polka dot glasses and has a white stripe in her hair. Very manic pixie dream girl.
Perfect for a children's bookseller, I answer.
I spot Rhea going by, stalking a canapé from a caterer's tray, and I try to catch her eye for a distraction. But she just gives me a wry smile that either means, hang in there, or resistance is futile.
Or a date,
Victoria says, squeezing my shoulder in encouragement. I swallow, hunting for an out. I'm so tempted to say I'm seeing someone, but that's a lie, and I won't do that. Especially not when Joe is so close. I wish she were here beside me. But if she were, she'd learn my romantic histories secondhand, and I want to be the one to tell her. When the time is right, that is. Not now. Instead, I lean on a half-truth with Victoria. How about I keep your bookseller in mind for when I'm ready? Victoria's lips droop, sad sympathy descending onto her face.
Take your time, love. I understand.
Then she pats my shoulder and heads to chat with someone else. I've escaped relatively unscathed, so I take a few steps away from Victoria to study a painting of astronauts. Rhea comes up to me, shooting me a soft smile.
Are you doing okay with all this?
She waves a hand at the crowds. I assume she means the setups, since she must have heard Victoria, and I'm not sure I want to get into the details. I pick the fastest way out I can devise.
Definitely. And listen, about that feedback request the other week, I'd be happy to help any time you'd like. Happy is also a lie, but I don't mind so much if it lets me avoid discussing dates, setups, or Project Widower. Rhea's brown eyes sparkle.
That would be so great. Thank you.
Joe returns shortly, and I spend the next 15 minutes walking around the gallery with her, talking about art. Just art, that's all. And it's the best part of the event. Ocean on fire and all. I don't try to talk about the job we're both vying for. Instead, we discuss what's on the walls, and her company makes the rest of the event fly by. Once we leave, I have a new dilemma. I'm reluctant for the night to end, but I don't know how to steal Joe away. I want to, though. The four of us from Highsmith all fan out of Zora's gallery and onto the busy pavement. Passers-by light cigarettes, laugh with friends, tap away on their phones. It's past 8 at the end of the work week, when people naturally congregate. Packs of women in jeans and slouchy tops, men in skinny trousers and trendy boots, and then, impossibly, the four of us milling about. A gaggle of co-workers. It's been ages since I've done something social like this. Truthfully, I'm not sure this counts, but this work function evokes nights, years ago, when Violet and I would grab dinner with friends from uni, or see a play with Nigel and his wife. I'm not entirely sure why it feels similar. It shouldn't. Freddie and Rhea aren't a couple, neither are Joe and I. Perhaps the sense of déjà vu is why I don't want the night to end. A big, warm hand clamps down on my shoulder. It's Freddie.
I'm going to catch a lift back to the lovely Millie, but someone needs to see our new American friend home safely,
he says, gesturing to Joe. She rolls her eyes.
I'm fine. I can see myself to Charing Cross, no prob. It's only 2 miles, and I'm going to walk and enjoy the evening air. It's springtime in London, and I barely need a jacket.
Joe plucks at her burgundy sweater, one of those short numbers that makes my eyes stray to her chest. She's more than simply sexy. She looks like an art expert, perfectly put together in slinky jeans, flats, and a yellow blouse. Yellow seems to be her color. Fitting. The whole look works. She's artsy and trendy and pure sunshine. And I have to stop staring at her. Rhea shakes her head and chimes in.
We're not letting you wander home alone, Joe. But I'm taking the tube in the opposite direction, so, Heath, can you make sure she gets back to her flat safely?
Of course, I say evenly, giving nothing away. But bless them. Bless my co-workers for this brilliant collaboration. Best brainstorm ever. A chance to spend more time with Joe. I should avoid temptation and put her in a cab. And yet I know I won't do that. When I'm near her, I'm not strong enough.
You are a gentleman. After all,
Rhea teases as she pokes me in the arm. Okay, so that's how we're doing it. I won't return the poke, but I file it away as another friendly gesture that eludes me. Joe meets my gaze.
You don't mind, Heath?
I manage not to crack a huge grin that would betray how very much I don't mind. Not at all. I'm heading in the same direction. Covent Garden is close to her. But no one knows where I live. Can't let you wander through the London night all alone, I say. Joe makes an over-the-top shuddering gasp.
I wouldn't want to run into a victim of Jack the Ripper. Ooh, maybe we should go on a Jack the Ripper tour,
she says, then casts her gaze to Rhea.
Are those terrible or fun?
Rhea laughs.
Looks like you think it would be fun. I can take you on one if you want. It's not my cuppa. But I'm game for anything. My kind of friend,
Joe says, then brings Rhea in for a quick hug. 4 days on the job and Joe already has friends. Not just co-workers, but friends. That's not my style whatsoever. She's a mystery in some ways, but one I want to unravel.
I'll find a Jack the Ripper tour and we'll do it,
Rhea says. She and Freddie say their goodbyes and, at last, it's just Joe and me outside an art gallery on a warm late spring evening, crowds bustling by. "Do you have a thing for horror?" I ask the petite brunette.
"I have a thing for new things, and it just seems like one of those when in London deals," she says. "Plus, my friends back home say I should try to like the city."
I jerk my head back like she slapped me. "Wait, hold on. Did you say you don't like London?" She gives an impish grin.
"It's like a relationship status update on Facebook. London and me, well, let's just say, it's complicated."
I narrow my eyes. "This is serious, Joe. We need to dissect this. Get to the bottom of this anti-London affliction of yours."
"You've got 2 miles then," she says, pointing the other way. "I'm leasing a flat in Charing Cross."
"Then that's the way we shall go." We start along the street, and I'm eager to dive into this blasphemy about the place I adore. But first, there's still this elephant between us. I clear my throat. "So you're interested in the VP post?" She bounces excitedly in her silver flats as we weave through the crowds around a dance club with a line snaking down the block.
"I applied at Bancroft in New York before Miranda sold the house to Highsmith. Or rather, before she announced the sale. Making VP is kind of everything I've ever wanted. A chance to really prove myself."
As she talks, she brims with enthusiasm that I haven't felt in some time. At least not this genuinely. Not in this way that seems to come from the center of her soul. "You're quite good at what you do," I say. "You bring a certain energy to the group."
"So do you,"
she says, nudging my arm with her elbow. I roll my eyes. "You're a terrible liar, Joe Brennan." She fixes me with a curious look, her tone downright insistent.
"I mean it. You do have a certain energy, Heath."
"Energy is not the word people use to describe me where work is concerned," I say sternly. "More like distant, obtruse, cold."
"Also, never likes to go out. That's another."
"That goes along with doesn't play well with others," I offer. "Bet that's up there too."
"I don't know if that's true. You played well with me."
Her eyes twinkle as she casts a fluttering, doe-eyed gaze my way, flirty with exaggerated innocence. I can't be bothered to fight off a grin. It simply takes over as I return her flirting with my own. "You're an exception," I tell her. She is, in every sense of the word. Her smile burns off, replaced with a softness, a vulnerability.
"You're very good at distracting me," she says,
then schools her expression.
"And we were talking about you."
"Maybe that's why I wanted to distract you."
"I am undeterred. And as I was saying, you do bring an energy. It's a you energy, intense. You're quiet for a bit, but when you speak, your words are powerful, well thought out, articulate. Your insight is sharp. It makes others want to work harder. That's how I feel around you in the office, and it's a compliment, so take it," she says,
ending with mock petulance. I mime grabbing something out of thin air and putting it in my pocket. "There, I took it." She pats my arm.
"Good. And I think you'd nail any promotion you applied for, too."
Then she gasps, her eyes popping to cartoon character size.
"Oh, crap! You're applying, too?"
The question hangs in the air between us. Fuck this shit, indeed. "Yes, I threw my hat into the ring a couple weeks ago," I say darkly. Joe stops, grabs my arm, then groans.
"TJ would love that."
"Who's that? Brother? Friend?"
"One of my good friends in New York. He writes romance novels. You'll meet him someday."
She catches herself and blinks in startled confusion.
"I don't know why I said that."
"Maybe it feels like I will." I latch onto that notion. Meeting her friends sounds so dangerous, but so delightful. It sounds like a new way of living, a terrifying but wonderful one.
Maybe it does, she says. I can see it.
And why would he love that we're going after the same post?
He'd get a kick out of all the obstacles in our way, since that's, well, that's his job. To put obstacles in the way of his characters.
It sure feels like someone is masterminding this chess game of my life. Wish I knew the moves to make, but I don't even know the setup of the board. His wasn't the book you had when I met you, I ask.
No, I've read all his books. I'm waiting eagerly for his next one.
She drops her voice to a racy whisper, fanning her face.
They're swoony and quite sexy.
They sound delicious, I remark as we cross the street, sidestepping a crew of young men in leather jackets. Her eyes sparkle like I said just the right thing, and I'm glad I could make her happy.
They are tasty. Anyway, so you and I are co-workers and rivals now, in a way.
She gives me a playful stare.
Which means we're just going to have to be friends. I insist on it. You told me your dart secret, and you're walking me home, and we're not having that date. Therefore, we must be friends.
I want to groan and scoff. I want to print that dreadful word on a sock with the caption, "This just friends stuff is utter bullshit." I don't want to be just friends with her whatsoever. Yet I also know we can't be anything more. You don't romance your rival. But I don't scoff, groan or mock her. She makes too good of a case for friendship. I want to see her outside of work. I want to find a way to have her in my days. If friendship is the container for that, so be it. I accept your friendship offer, I say.
Good. Now let's talk about something besides work, she says, as friends do.
Well, since this is the new us, I'll begin again. How about London? I sweep an arm toward a double-decker bus trundling along, encompassing the red phone booth up ahead and the silhouette of the Savoy Hotel in the distance. Why on earth don't you love the best city in the world? We have great art, wonderful shops, diverse culture, theater, museums, music, history, and all of Europe just across the channel. And yes, the food gets a bad rap, but that's only if you don't know where to go. London actually has fantastic cuisine. We cross the street, nearing a nouveau Middle Eastern restaurant. Take that spot. When my friend Griffin was here a few months ago, we had the best lentil and falafel dishes there, as well as braised asparagus and olives that were simply divine. Jo presses a hand to her stomach.
Don't say such tempting things.
I sense an opportunity I don't want to miss. Nodding to the restaurant, I ask, do you want to get a bite? Her lips curve up.
The thing we weren't going to do on a Friday night.
The plans we cancelled because it was such a bad idea to do otherwise. But if you're both hungry at the same time, and there's a restaurant right there, that sounds more like serendipity. Friends have dinner, Joe.
Well, that is true, Heath.
And you can just think of it like, we're just happening upon the cafe. It's not planned like a date would be, I say with a bit of cheek.
Ooh, just say coincidental dining?
Her grin says she likes this loophole, a friendship exemption. Exactly. That's all it is between friends, I say, ever so casual.
Between friends,
she says, wholly flirty. I set a hand on her back. Then let me take you to some coincidental eating. May I? She raises her chin to meet my eyes. Hers glimmer with yes, and my chest flips. That's something I haven't felt in ages, or maybe since Sunday night. I want that feeling again and again, that heady buzz like she and I are the only two people in a city of millions. Perhaps that's the deja vu tonight, these feelings I'd almost forgotten, until her.
You may, she says.
I guide her into the restaurant and ask for a table for two.
Ah, you're in luck.
the hostess says. We just had a cancellation.
Almost like this is where we were supposed to wind up tonight. Almost like fate. After we order, I return the conversation to London. Tell me why your relationship with my homeland is complicated. You said you were here for grad school. Did something happen? As soon as I ask, her mood shifts, her eyes darken.
A lot of things happened.
What sort of things? May I ask? I'm wildly curious, aching to know her more, but I don't want to pressure her. I simply hope she wants to share. She glances behind her as if checking for eavesdroppers, then leans closer over the table.
My father lives here.
It comes out like a heavy confession. The admission surprises me, too, because it seems a contradiction. Family in town should be a good thing. I like being near my parents, seeing them from time to time. There's a lot to this story, I say. Her eyes are shadowed with sadness, perhaps regret.
Yeah, there is.
I presume he's one of the reasons you don't like London, I say, concern thrumming through me. Do you have a strained relationship? She drags her lower lip along her teeth, eyes swinging away from me, then back.
He's hard on me. Always has been. My mother was the you-can-do-it type, and he's the you'll-have-your-work-cut-out-for-you type. He likes to tell me that I'm biting off more than I can chew, that a VP position is out of my reach.
Before I can do more than tut, she shakes her head as if shaking off my sympathy.
But that's not the huge thing. That's just him. Professor and noted hard-ass. I can handle that.
She draws a deep breath, as if she needs extra strength for the next words.
It's his wife that I struggle with. Or, rather, it's the two of them together.
And why is that? I ask carefully, sensing these are dangerous waters for her heart. Her blue eyes darken with hurt and anger.
He's married to my best friend from college.
Chapter 12. Joe. It's not a state secret. I don't keep data like that password protected. My friends know Poppy married my father 10 years ago. But I haven't yet been on a date where I've wanted to share those details, where I've wanted a man to understand more about me, to see me for who I am, to know about the part of me that makes me this person. Except this isn't truly a date, so maybe